Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talked to Stephen Bush and George Eaton about the fiscal charter, whatever that is, and a very stormy meeting of the PLP. Then Anna Leskovitz talks to Kate Mossman about her blockbusting interview with Terence Trent D'Arby, who says he died when he was 27. It's been another turbulent week for Labour, with a reversal by John McDonnell on whether or not they would vote in favour of Osborne's fiscal responsibility charter. I'm joined by Stephen Bush, our Staggers editor, and our politics editor, George Eaton, to explain exactly what's going on. Stephen, let's start with the fiscal responsibility charter. In words of, I was going to say words of one syllable, but maybe like two syllables or less, can you explain the various kind of reversals that they've been through and really what the kind of tactical ideas behind them were?
So the fiscal charter is a statutory instrument, so it's passed through the Commons, which means that the government is not allowed to, in normal times, quote unquote, not keep an absolute surplus. So that's both a surplus in terms of day-to-day spending, but also in terms of borrowing. So it's not just how much money, it's basically saying not only will I not go into debt to buy food, it's also saying I won't go into my overdraft to replace a car or to service my mortgage or any sort of other existing debts I might have.
And George, you floated the idea, which was denied by John McDonnell, Labour's Shadow Chancellor, that perhaps they hadn't read the detail of it carefully enough and hadn't kind of got this distinction between running a current budget surplus, which I think most people would say is a reasonable aspiration. Maybe it's, you know, some economists would say, actually, what's the point of a surplus at all? And an overall surplus, i.e. you're not allowed to borrow for big infrastructure projects or anything like that. Is that, that's the kind of calculation? But they now say that's not true, right?
Yes, so John McDonnell is denying that's the case. But the reason a lot of Labour MPs suspected he hadn't read the charter properly is when he was interviewed before the Labour conference and said they were going to vote for the fiscal charter, he also said that he supported borrowing for investment, which the charter effectively outlaws. So there was always that contradiction there, and the question was always, how is it going to be resolved? And it appeared for a period that Labour would vote for the charter, but say it's a meaningless charter, therefore our support for it is meaningless, and we're not going to allow him to cast us as deficit deniers. So that seemed to be the political logic. But I think there were other forces that motivated the U-turn. Kezia Dugdale, the Scottish Labour leader, made it very clear to John McDonnell that she thought Labour tactically was wrong to vote in favour of the fiscal charter because it would hand the SNP another chance to outflank them from the left.
And say, we're the real anti-austerity party.
Exactly that. And there were also Labour backbenchers, such as John Mann, who sits on the Treasury Select Committee, who were prepared to vote against the charter and effectively rebel, and who made it clear to McDonnell that it would be quite odd for backbenchers that they tend to think of as to the right of them to be voting against the charter while they vote for it.
And Stephen, it was quite an extraordinary scene in the Commons when John McDonnell said it was embarrassing, and he said it was embarrassing about five times because people were kind of shouting that they had done this U-turn. Was that the right decision, just to front it up and go, I've changed my mind, here's why?
No, it wasn't. I mean, partly because the problem is he obviously is not being straight about the reasons for the U-turn. They clearly hadn't read it, because when it came out, and I did a piece going, oh no, well, what they'll do is that it just means that they're going to try and win the argument for a massive tax hike. And I got some pushback on this. Yeah, going, oh, no, this isn't the case. It's like, oh, well, you haven't read it then. And what they
so they would have been in a problem, basically, because they'd already committed that they wouldn't raise the top tax rate above 50p. So they haven't got a huge, obvious tax-raising instrument. They then couldn't borrow, but also they weren't going to make cuts. So they were left in the situation where actually you couldn't mash all those three bits
they
together.
It basically would have meant that they would have had to say, we will increase basic rate and higher rate
of income tax.
Except, of course, what tax. They would actually say is, we believe we can save $120 billion through cracking down on tax avoidance and tax evasion. And
the tax avoidance sofa that has so much money behind it every time.
But they have already retreated a bit from the tax avoidance sofa.
because, that's what it's called.
Well, because the problem is the second you start on the tax avoidance sofa and you say, but we also want to invest in high-tech jobs or whatever... Well, some of that avoidance sofa is where companies are given leeway to invest in new tech.
I think it was Facebook paid under £5,000 in corporation tax in the UK last year. So you can't really say on one hand, I think this is a brilliant company, this is developing the kind of jobs that we need in our economy, but equally well, I'm also going to go and hit them with a big stick until they cough up a bit more
tax. The interesting thing with Facebook and tax is the way they avoided paying corporation tax is they paid all of their staff a bonus, which they then paid tax on. There's an open question about whether or not the net tax gain is... So, because the thing is, there are two questions about taxation. There's the wonkish case about how much money you get in, and there's a moral case. Mm. Should a corporation pay more tax? They after all benefit from the schools, the roads, the healthcare, etc., etc. I think that's quite a strong argument. On the other hand, there's the crude calculation of...
How much money are we actually getting in at
the end of the story? And then perhaps there's an argument for increasing the amount than they force out. I mean, we do have not just the lowest corporation tax rate in the G7, but it is so much lower than any of the others than you'd think there probably is some wiggle room.
Before this becomes Stephen's tax half hour, which is, I'm sure, will be something we do for another time. I just want to take, George, I want to take you back to the PLP meeting on Tuesday night, which was incredibly fraught, not least because they've got very thin walls and all the journalists can sit outside, and therefore if anyone starts bellowing particularly loudly, it's quite audible. It sounded like a shambles. I mean, as you wrote, Ben Bradshaw strode out and said it was a shambles. Emily Thornberry, I think, was telling them, basically saying that, stop texting journalists outside. I can see their tweets. They're tweeting mean things about us. Is that a fair reflection of how badly it went? Or is that once again the evil mainstream media knocking it?
No, that is a fair reflection of how badly it went. In fact, after my report, several MPs said to me, no, it's even worse than you described. And you had veteran MPs who have been in the Commons for perhaps 30 years and who'd never seen anything like it. They said, never seen it this bad. I think the reason it was so fraught, it was because the first meeting since the conference season. So a lot had happened in the interim and there was a lot of heat they had to let out. So they were angry about Jeremy Corbyn not being inducted into the Privy Council, allowing the media to take another hit on him over that and cast him as unpatriotic again. They were angry about John McDonnell's reversal on the U-turn. And there was a lot of unrest and suspicion about the launch of a new group called Momentum, which is billed as a grassroots movement designed to harness the energy of the Corbyn campaign, but which MPs opposed to Jeremy Corbyn fear will be used to deselect them. And they weren't briefed in advance of the launch. So there's a huge amount of suspicion about that. All of this came out at the meeting.
Stephen, talking about Momentum, it's been launched by John Lansman, who is a veteran activist who was in favour of mandatory reselection and deselection in his time. Does that mean that MPs are right to be worried? Because it also seems to me that it is not an unreasonable thing that you would have, as you had Progress, as you had Compass, that you would have, given that this is not a dominant faction in the PLP, even though obviously the members were very much into it, that it's not necessarily completely sinister, is it?
I mean, I think it can both be reasonable and sinister. There is an open question about whether or not mandatory reselection is a good thing. John Lansman thinks then and still thinks now it is. So there are two things that you hear about Momentum. One, isn't there going to be this movement for change style do-gooding organisation where they go around like lifting up plant pots, which, if they do is lovely and that is great. But the flip side of that is Movement for Change has existed for 5 years. It has fixed some people's gates, but in terms of its stated aim, which was to get more people involved in the Labour Party, it has been a catastrophic failure. There were very few Movement for Changes who signed up to vote in the leadership election. And in the two key seats where they did a lot of really worthwhile social stuff, Great Yarmouth and Cardiff North, Labour went backwards on 2010. So there are sort of two possibilities with Momentum. Either it's going to do all of this social stuff, in which case, yeah, that's wonderful for the people who benefit for it, but it is pretty pointless for the Labour Party. Or, as seems more likely to me, because when Landsman incorporated the company, which is now Momentum, to keep the campaign data from the campaign so they knew where their supporters were, it's because they thought they would lose, but they wanted to be able to organise for NEC elections, selections, elections to the National Policy Forum, all of these things where, you know, power within the party resides. And of course they will organise on that basis. I mean, you'd have to be... It would just be such a strange thing not to do. Like, they want to move the party towards their bit of politics. So I think if I was a moderate MP, I would be a bit nervous, because that is one of the blunt instruments you have, is the ability to change the parliamentary party.
Yeah. George, the conclusion that you kind of come to in your column this week is that Jeremy Corbyn isn't going anywhere for all the kind of low-grade derm and strang that there is. But there are some interesting points. I mean, Stephen's talked about deselection, but about also the way the kind of legacy that Corbyn and his team want to institute about the leadership campaign, which I'm sure will be that any rule changes in that will be incredibly contested. There's an excellent statement by Ken Livingstone that he thinks anyone should be able to get on the ballot with only two nominations in future. Then you've got Frank Field on the other side saying that if anyone gets deselected, they should stand again as an independent. I'm sure some people will keep talking about the fact that, you know, is this a party that can hold together with such disparate elements within it?
Yes. I mean, I think it can hold together in the sense that there won't be a formal split. Labour MPs have seen that film before. It didn't end well in the 1980s when you had the SDP breakaway. Even those who are most critical of Jeremy Corbyn and most opposed to him see themselves as tribally Labour. It's their party. They're not going anywhere. And certainly I don't think there'll be any defections. But the possibility that Frank Field floats, I mean, it's not impossible, I suppose, if someone is deselected, that they would be tempted to run as an independent in those circumstances. I mean, it's not an impossible scenario. But it's interesting that Field and Livingstone are both publicly speculating about issues like leadership rule changes and deselections, which just shows that what an issue it is within the party. And certainly in terms of the future of the left, were the leadership rules changed, and of course Corbyn could try and attempt that now, it would guarantee that you could have a left winger on the ballot. And given the political makeup of the membership now, anyone who had Jeremy Corbyn's explicit or implicit endorsement would be in a strong position.
I'm not so sure. In 1981, when Tony Benn ran for the deputy leadership, he got 81% of votes among members, but he lost because they had an electoral college. Eric Heffer, his designated successor, when he ran for the leadership after the 1983 election, got 7% of the vote. These things are not as portable.
So you think it's a kind of, I mean, that's, but that's
as
the,
people
that's,
think.
But that's also a kind of question of personality, isn't it? Because I think that Jeremy Corbyn's got a big personal. People just liked the story of this kind of quiet, mild-mannered guy who'd been, you know, who kind of comes to work on a bicycle, hasn't. I mean, particularly post expenses, quite obviously hasn't trousered huge kind of amounts of money and is living in high style. There is a possibility, though, isn't there, that another of the 2015 candidates, the kind of Corbynista MPs, could. You know, they have got some very compelling stories among some of them.
I think
they could recreate that magic again.
My instinct is that what will happen is either Jeremy Corbyn or his chosen successor will lead Labour into the 2020 election. However, my growing sense is that Jeremy himself will decide he wants to lead Labour into the 2020 election. One of the interesting things that happened in the reshuffle is there is not an obvious successor to Corbyn from the Corbyn flank who he could pass on to. One of the reasons why I don't think there'll be this rule change to allow anyone onto the ballot is then he becomes less irreplaceable to...
Immediately.
Yeah, immediately to the left of the Labour Party. And there are lots of people in the membership who I think are more sympathetic to Corbyn than they are to the left in general within Labour.
I think that that's
but
the one
that
comes across.
I think there are lots of lefties who actually would prefer... You know, there are left-wing MPs in the parliamentary party who think Clive Lewis is a better media performer, who would prefer to have someone like that.
Well,
and
I think there's a big thing about people wanting to kind of get somebody who is fresh, because actually one of the things that's been kind of exhausting for Corbyn is defending 30 years of previous previous public statements. Whereas if you are somebody who is kind of a clean skin, that gives you a huge advantage, I guess.
Yeah.
It's SNP conference this weekend, so we'll be talking a bit about that next week. Until then, thank you very much to Stephen and George.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously.
This week, we talk about the absolute farce that is Downton Abbey. So if you'd like to join us as we rant and rave, please do.
You can find us at newstatesman.com/SRSLY or on iTunes or any podcatcher of your choice.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Anna Leskovich, and I'm here with Kate Mossman, who last week interviewed Terence Trent D'Arby for the magazine. Terence now calls himself Sananda Maitreya, and one of the conditions of your interview was that you weren't to bring up his old name, is that right?
Yeah, it's a painful memory, basically. He renamed himself officially in 2001, but he started to call himself Sananda after a series of dreams in the mid-1990s.
Well, I think that detail sort of characterises what the interview's like, so if you haven't read it already, you must. But Kate, so you were just saying off-air, everyone of a certain age knows about Terence Trent D'Arby, but for anyone out there who doesn't, can you just explain a bit about who he is?
He was a strange figure, and I was a child when his big record came out, 1987. He was just in the consciousness. He was so heavily promoted by his record label that in the course of doing this article, I realised that he was demanding cover interviews before he'd even had a record out. There was a tremendous push from his label at the point. They just thought he was the perfect rock star. And the funny thing about it was that the music journalists went mad for him as well, because he was beautiful. He looked like Jimi Hendrix. He sounded like Sam Cooke. He danced like James Brown. He was bringing this kind of very slick, sort of super polished soul in at the end of the 80s. He also had a bit of Prince in him. He was mentored by Prince. He was in love with Michael Jackson. He was just this perfect figure, and his first record sold apparently 1 million copies in 3 days. He was 25 years old.
And this piece had 1 million views in 3 days.
This piece had 1 million views in 3 days.
History repeats itself.
Yes, there is a sense of there's only one way to go but down with that, isn't there?
Yeah. Hopefully not for you.
Yeah.
So what happened? How did that downward spiral come about?
He claimed famously that his first album was going to be bigger than Sgt. Pepper. And he claimed that he was a genius. And now, he said these things. Yes, they were all there. They're all there in print. But he was sort of goaded to say them by the press. And he'd studied journalism for a year at the University of Florida. He was a very bright young man. He'd got a scholarship to Florida University. He knew how the press worked. And he also had been stationed near Frankfurt with Elvis Presley's old regiment when he was in the army. And all the time he was living in Germany, he'd devoured the NME and Melody Maker. And he knew that the British rock hacks, who were kind of a notoriously arch bunch in the 1970s and 80s, held a lot of power. He knew that they found American artists boring to interview.
Right.
And he explained this to me, and he's completely right about this. He said, American artists, they thank their mum, they thank Jesus, and they say every new record is their best one yet. And it's true that it's very difficult to get a real interview out of an American artist, because there's a kind of veneer of media training. It's a very kind of polite process. They're always blessed by their experience. They're blessed by their career. And he set out to be different, basically. So he threw these lines at the press that he knew were going to make headlines, like, I am a genius, point effing blank, he said when he was 25. And every single piece that was written about him was filled with speculation about the fact he could only go down. So it was strange. He created a kind of monster.
Yeah, that's funny, though, because I feel like a lot of artists that are really famous now, like, the obvious comparison is obviously Kanye West, say things like that all the time, and it doesn't seem to be a bad omen.
He was completely ahead of his time in that respect. Lady Gaga said it. She said, I am famous, you just haven't heard of me yet. And everyone loved it in 2009, 2010, because the era that Terence Trent D'Arby came out with was over. Like, we had no... There was no money in the industry anymore. There was no grand kind of characters. Everyone was much more transparent. They're all on Twitter. You can see what they're having for breakfast. They're not selling that many records. So when someone like Kanye or Gaga comes along and says, I am a genius, you're going to, you know, I'm the biggest thing since whatever. We love that now. But back at in the late 80s, it wasn't actually particularly fashionable. It was quite a self-conscious era. This was the yuppie era, you know, mm-hmm. he was selling to a yuppie audience. And it was not particularly cool what he was doing. And he just got carried away with it, really. And I think it was just the real reason that his career failed was that his second record, he demanded that he produce it, master it, engineer it himself. And it didn't have any singles on it. It was not a commercial thing. And it sold 300,000 copies when his first one sold 9 million. And he just gradually petered out after that. He didn't disappear, but he thinks he disappeared, so...
So what was it like to talk to him about that? I mean, presumably it must have been quite difficult to get him to speak about why his career collapsed in that sense. How willing was he to speak with you about it?
I thought it was going to be difficult, but he hadn't done a face-to-face interview for, by the sounds of it, quite a long time. He was very nervous, but once he started talking, he did have this kind of automatic quality to his speech. And he was full of the most bizarre creative reasons for his career failure. You know, Michael Jackson was responsible. There were death threats on him. There were debates in the House of Lords about why his career had to be tanked. He didn't really talk about Sananda Maitreya, the happy creative man living in Milan with two kids writing records. He talked about the past the whole time. So he was an amazing contradiction between somebody who claimed they didn't want the past dredging up, they didn't even want their old name mentioned, and somebody who for 2.5 hours did nothing but talk about the era.
Pitching a scab, isn't it?
Yes, completely. It was quite a sort of sad experience in a strange kind of way to doing the interview.
How self-aware do you think he is?
He was always a self-mythologist, and he made his story was already fascinating. An army boy, you know, could have gone professional as a boxer, all sorts of things, but he made his story even more apocryphal and amazing than it actually was. And one of the problems with that is if you tell lots of different versions of your story to lots of different journalists, you sort of lose track of who you've told what. And I got a very strong sense that he does believe a lot of the things that he claimed to have happened to him, especially the kind of conspiracies against him and stuff. I was never any moment thinking that this guy is just turning it on for the press, partly because there was something so sort of sad in the way that he spoke, and an urgency about it as well. It wasn't someone acting. It was a very strange thing. I think as well, the thing that struck me is that these people are so young when they get, you know, when I was 25 years old, I didn't even have a shred of a notion what I wanted to do with my career. I didn't have half the social skills I have now. He was that age when he took off. Eric Clapton was about 19 or 20 when people realised that he was a genius. Paul McCartney was only 28 when he was working on Abbey Road. I mean, it's impossible to believe that, but that the Beatles, when they were working on their last record, were still in their 20s. And the amount of stuff that you have to kind of take on emotionally before you're fully formed, I don't know how they did it. And I think his story is an example of somebody who got carried away with that and suffered the consequences of the hype that was put on him by the press, by his own label, and by himself ultimately.
Kate, what do you think about some of those albums looking back? Like, is the first one as good as it seemed at the time? Are the other ones as bad as they seemed at the time?
Well, the funny thing is, yeah, I listened back to the famous second album that mm-hmm. tanked. And no, I mean, it would fly now because we don't expect to sell records anymore. So I think there's a good comparison with someone like Janelle Monáe, for instance, mm-hmm. who I think is fantastic. Her first record was a huge two-sided concept album about robots, and it had one or two amazing songs on it, and also lots of kind of strange musical interludes. And you listen to that, and whenever that came out, 2010, everyone was like, oh, this girl's a genius. So things have changed. Back in the days when records were still selling in their millions, it just wasn't commercial. So I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff. And if you listen to what he's doing now, he releases loads of records nowadays. There's a huge ambition there. There's a great knowledge of how to write a really good tune. His voice is good, but they're also kind of batty. They're all over the place. There's no producer, there's no editor, and there's no A&R team at all trying to sort of shape him into any commercial kind of state.
Yeah, I think that's in a way what you want from a pop star nowadays. You want these big egos who are fairly controlling and stuff. Do you think if, you know, the story of Terence Trent D'Arby had happened 20 years later, it would have been a different story?
I think you're right, and I also think he could have possibly happened a bit earlier, you know, in the days of the golden gods of the early 1970s, the Rolling Stone era that he was in love with. He would have, his proclamations would have gone down well. And it was funny, I actually asked him in the interview, I said, did you ever feel like you were born too early or too late? And he actually winced. His eyes kind of widened, and I thought, this is painful. This is actually something he's thought about before. Yes, if only I was coming out now, or yes, if only I'd come out then. Who knows whether that's true, but it was definitely something that he's thought about, and I think it's a, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe his music will get rediscovered again. There's a lot of people talking about it at the moment.
Yeah, but, definitely. Yeah, maybe your piece will reignite a fire. Kate, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.